Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
And you're continuing a short, small tradition. You brought beer tonight, Hannah.
Yes, continuing the two-week tradition. I figured anything had to be better than the beer you brought last week.
And the beer I brought last week, which was a Waradaka Cupid's Curse, would have fit perfectly tonight. Cupid's Curse would fit perfectly with a movie we're going to discuss called Before I Fall. But I haven't seen what you brought. I tasted it. It tastes like an IPA.
Yeah, no, it's a decent little beer. It's a craft beer, and it is called Primal Pale Ale. And if you notice the logo,
it's got a wolf on it.
And what would a wolf signify, Charlie? Wolverine. I know it's a stretch.
Is a wolverine a dog?
I don't know. No, it's not. I thought it's a wolf.
It's Wouldn't not a wolf.
Would wolverine be associated with a wolf?
No.
Really? Are you sure?
Wolverines have nothing to do with wolves.
Oh, well. The W-O-L. That's about all you get. I searched and searched and searched the aisles of this poor little wine shop. I had four different employees all trying to find something relevant. It was just one of those weeks.
Wow, you put in a lot of effort.
I know. Despite the fact that we have as many movies as we do this week, you would have thought something would have popped out. But sorry, the wolf is a stretch for Wolverine, which is a stretch for Logan.
If you didn't bring something tonight, I had a bottle of wine ready called the Stump Jump, and it would have been so inappropriate.
Okay.
You didn't see the movie. It's called Land of Mine, and it's about what happens when landmines blow off your appendages.
Oh.
The Stump Jump.
Oh, yeah. That would have been a little bit distasteful, Charlie.
Well, we are talking about five different films tonight. However, we each only saw four. You saw one I didn't see. Mm-hmm. I saw one you didn't see. And there's one we both didn't see, a big wide release that they didn't show us because we are not Christian critics, so we did not see The Shack.
Yeah, I saw Octavia Spencer on something the other day, and I was thinking nobody really knows anything about this movie, and it's got some star power.
But, it's got 19% on Rotten Tomatoes, too.
I know. I mean, I haven't heard anything positive about it, but that's what happens when they don't screen it for critics. You automatically assume
these standard, it's a dud. You know, you get a couple of them a year, they're overt Christian church-going films, so they're going to make a ton of money in their sector. And they only show them to the select few people who identify as Christian critics. And they only show it to them, you know, like the God's Not Dead franchise. And this is going to fall into that category.
But I saw that, what was it, Miracles from Heaven? That would have fallen into the same category. And they showed that to us. But anyway.
Well, we have a very, very big blockbuster, probably the first big blockbuster of the year of 2017 to talk about today. And that's Logan, the new X. It's not really an X-Man film. There are two prior X-Men in it. It's a closure. It's a farewell movie. It's Hugh Jackman's ninth time playing Wolverine. Some people say 10, but you cannot count his face on the magazine in Deadpool.
which is one of my favorites.
Some people are saying that's 10, but if you can't count Deadpool. It's also Patrick Stewart's supposed last time playing Professor Xavier. Now, Hannah, for the last couple weeks, I'm tired of not fighting with you. Like, I want to fight with you on something, but even on this one, I don't think we're going to fight. Because I believe we're both in the minority. Logan has, like, a 93%. People are saying this is a great comic book movie, the superhero movie that's real and gritty and edgy. And no, Logan's just miserable, Hannah.
I feel like there's a shame game going on by other critics. Like, they are making it sound as if we didn't enjoy this movie, then we just don't get it. We just don't understand that there's a reason that it's dark and brooding and not entertaining, and that, yes, this is not your typical superhero Marvel movie, and it was designed that way. And so, you know, you need to really embrace the fact that it's not an entertaining Marvel movie, and if you don't like that, too bad. And so that's how I felt, and I was not entertained by this movie. I went in really half expecting a more traditional Marvel superhero type of film, or even something that was just more in line with the other Wolverine movies. But it was, it's bloody, it's violent, it's kind of a brutal journey to sit through. And I just was personally disappointed. And it's not even hot Hugh Jackman, so that's even doubly disappointing.
I do not mind R-rated dark comic book movies. Deadpool. It worked. It was fantastic. It was one of the best movies of 2016. I don't mind X-Men movies. I loved X-Men Days of Future Past.
That one was good.
I do not like standalone Wolverine films. I didn't like 2009's X-Men Origins Wolverine. I did not like 2013's The Wolverine, where he goes to Japan to fight ninjas and a big robot. And I didn't like Logan. And it's not because it is really extremely violent. You finally get to see what his adamantium claws do to skulls. And that didn't bother me. That bothered some critics in the audience. That didn't bother me. What bothered me was I hated this story. I don't want to see broken down Wolverine, alcoholic, confused Wolverine, and geriatric 90-year-old Professor Xavier. It's about as fun as watching someone change an adult diaper.
Yeah.
This is directed by James Mangold. He also directed 2013's The Wolverine, and probably one of your favorite Hugh Jackman films ever, Kate and Leopold.
Oh, I love that movie. Classic.
This guy who did Logan did Kate and Leopold.
How did this happen? I don't understand, because this is not going to appeal to the Kate and Leopold crowd. I can guarantee you that.
Well, it's set in the year 2029, and I did the math on that. In 2029, I'll be the same age you are right now.
In other words, it's right around the corner.
Exactly. But there's something wrong with the timeline here. It doesn't fit. It's its own movie. It doesn't fit in an X-Men timeline. And the X-Men timeline already requires someone with a PhD, because they've had movies that have time travel, that go back and forth, that have created alternate realities. So I have no idea where even regular X-Men timelines are, let alone this thing, because it skips over something that must have happened that was very big, the mutant cleansing. There are barely any mutants left alive in this world, Hannah.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure where exactly that was supposed to have started. I am not one of these people that knows the mythology in and out and knows all the comic books that, you know, like some of the fanboys will just be obsessed with deciphering every single element of these types of movies. It was very sad to see this Professor Xavier as I think he's maybe in some, I wouldn't even say early stage Alzheimer's. It's probably later stage Alzheimer's. He's got some kind of brain disease going on. And then every time he has some seizure, he causes all this upheaval to happen around him. And it just is, I mean, just nothing's fun. Even when it looks for a moment like it's taking a turn towards fun, when there's almost like this makeshift family road trip movie that starts somewhere in the middle of this movie when they're going to try and rescue this girl and who's got powers very similar to Logan's and take her to some Eden in North Dakota, South Dakota, somewhere in the Dakotas. I had a feeling that, oh, now the movie's going to become more of a family drama with a little bit of comedy in it. But no, claws come out everywhere, and there's a lot of blood. It's hyper-violent. These characters are introduced and killed off, and I just could not wait for this movie to end.
Logan is part Western, part neo-noir, and it is road trip cross-country movie. Logan takes Professor X and the girl named Laura. He doesn't want to. He's a reluctant hero, but like... the continuous parallel of Shane, the 1953 Western.
Shane.
He's being compared to Shane. So like Shane, he's got to do the right thing, even though he may not want to do it. He's got to do the right thing. So he's protecting this little girl, Laura. By the way, this is her first film ever. Her name's Daphne Keane.
She's good.
She's from Spain. She's awesome.
I like her.
She's really good. She reminded me of Hit Girl from Kick-Ass, those films, but without the personality. Because, she has no personality. The villains here are part of an evil corporation. They are creating mutants. They're cloning mutant genes into babies and trying to raise super soldiers. You mentioned the claws keep coming out. There's a knockoff Wolverine in this film. He's called X-24. And he takes so much flesh and bone out of the Wolverine we know, out of Logan, that I can't believe there are still a human being left to walk around. The amount of gore that he causes.
Well, to say that heads roll in this movie, that's literal. So be prepared. And the movie, but, you know, you mentioned these this crop of kids that are being experimented on. That's really, in essence, I guess what they're trying to do with this movie is just set up the next generation of X-Men type characters. And so that's where the film, it finds its heart and the future of the franchise in the final 5 minutes of this film.
Well, I don't think they're ever going to go back to these kids. This is a standalone movie that I think will stand alone. I think they're going to go back to all the, you know, like the James McAvoy kind of business that we know.
Yeah, but this has potential to go back if they were to decide to do that. I certainly, you know, would like to go back and see the James McAvoy versions again. But I don't know how they can really do that without Wolverine reappearing, and that's not the intent of this movie. So
to emphasize, we are in the minority. There's some people out there that love this film, and they cried. They cried during this film, and it gave them the feels. I loathed this film. I thought it was so long. I just wanted it to end. I was miserable.
I hate to agree, but I do.
See, and that's what I'm talking about. I'm tired of agreeing with you, Hannah. We're supposed to be fighting over a film, especially like Logan.
All right, I'll just have a sip of my beer and move on to the next one.
All right, the next one, it's another wide release this week. It's called Before I Fall. It's aimed at the young adult crowd because it's based on a 2010 young adult novel by a woman named Lauren Oliver, and it's plagiarized. It has to be plagiarized.
It's not plagiarized.
It is Groundhog Day, but it's not Bill Murray waking up to Sonny and Cher every morning. It's Zoe Deutsch waking up as a really good-looking high school senior every morning, and she's not a nice person. She, you know, Bill Murray figured it out after a while, you know, I need to stop being a horrible person and, like, help the world. Samantha doesn't figure it out either. She tries being nice as the last thing. So I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it. Are you disagreeing with me that it's straight up a ripoff?
No, I think there's how many original, truly original things are there in the movies?
But this one's so...
But there is a similar book, but for the same way
and that, the book is plagiarized.
Well, but for the same way that people go, oh, well, you know, 50 Shades is a plagiarized version of Twilight that's just amped up.
Don't get me started on the Twilight plagiarizing.
I know, but so I'm just saying that that's what happens is these things evolve and somebody goes, oh, here's a good concept. I am going to tweak this concept for a different audience. And so Groundhog Day was enough years ago that the young adults of today are not going to feel like it's being ripped off. It's one of those things that if you've never seen it before, it's new to you.
But the young kids have seen it. It's called Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. That was not necessarily original, but it was great. This is just garbage.
I mean, Edge of Tomorrow is the better movie, without a doubt. But this is Groundhog Day for the Twilight crowd. It just is.
And it looks like Twilight.
It looks like Twilight.
Set in a town somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. It's gray. It's rainy. There's a filter on the lens to make it look darker than it really is, I believe. And they're all rich. Oh, my Lord, these people got some money.
Yeah. Well, and the whole idea, so it's, you know, she's this high school senior who, it's a mystery that's sort of unraveling as she realizes that she's living what is possibly the last day of her life over and over and over again. And as it dawns on you that this could be the last day of your life, what are you going to do to make things different? And so you start to see how, in typical high school fashion, how, you know, the groupthink that was going on and whether or not what seemed like a perfect set of friends and a perfect boyfriend really were. And it's, I don't know, I didn't realize until after I had seen it and was talking about it to other people, just how many people I know have actually read the book. And I did not read the book. I did not realize before I saw it that there was a book. So for fans of the book, they might be inclined to go see this. Will it break through the rest of the clutter of things that are out there this weekend for anyone beyond the young adult crowd? I sincerely doubt it.
I find it very amusing that the day Samantha must repeat over and over again is her lose her virginity day. It's February 12th.
Valentine's Day.
It's February 12th. So at high school, it's called Cupid Day, and that's where anonymous people can buy you roses, and they're delivered to you in front of the class so everyone knows who's more popular, who gets all the roses. And Samantha gets a lot of roses. Mm-hmm. She's part of the mean girl clique. She's not the leader, though. She's a follower, and she's kind of like the nicest girl in the mean girl clique. But she doesn't, you know, she doesn't protect any victims, and she kind of joins in on the on the teasing. The lead mean girl, her name is Lindsay. She's played by Halston Sage. She's mean. She mm-hmm. is downright, she can be downright evil. She drives a late model SUV, chauffeuring her girls to school, her bays to school. She provides the coffee, and she's a ringleader of just nastiness.
Well, but it's sort of that, it's that high school mean girls type of thing going on. But you also see that that none of the characters are pure evil or pure good. So that's kind of what's going on as she's unraveling the mystery of what might have happened on this day that she's stuck living over and over again. That it's about sort of finding the good or finding the best in the people and then just rectifying situations that... that you were destined to rectify. So it's I mean, I can't defend it as being a great movie because it's not. It was, to me, it was just kind of boring. And it gets old. You know, Groundhog Day managed to keep itself fun even while things were repeating. This one, you reach the point where you're like, how many times are we going to have to see this over and over again before it's resolved?
I don't know how you can say you don't know if none of the characters are either bad nor good. They're all one note. They're the, you know, the stereotypical high school people. You there's the guy who, there's the dumb jock, the guy she wants to lose her virginity to. There's the lesbian who just acts as the lesbian. There's the victim. There's the guy who, her not so secret admirer.
Oh, it's, right. Forgot about him.
They all have their one thing. No one is complex. No one's three dimensional.
No, but they're probably drawn pretty much the way they are in the book. And so it's just a young adult mystery. That's really all it is. I think you might be overthinking it.
I remember right when I didn't know what the movie was about. I went in blind. And when she woke up, you know, the first day, and when we realized, oh my God, it's Groundhog Day. I remember I leaned over to you and was like, I hate this effing movie.
Oh, that's right. Now I remember now just watching how much you were hating this as
because
it went on.
Got on my nerves. The lighting. Turn on a light. Like someone's got to have an overhead light instead of these lamps in the corner. The kids are too old. In real life, they should be out of college by now. They are too old to be playing high schoolers, and it looked it. All right, now here's one for you. I want to see if you can answer this question. Anne Hornaday, the lead Washington Post critic, probably the most famous critic in Washington, D.C., She tweeted a question today, and she says, is Before I Fall an example of a gender gap? As in, guys are not liking this movie, but women will defend it. Do you see this as a gender gap film?
I do. And interestingly enough, Gloria Steinem, I believe, had an op-ed in the New York Times the other day about chick flicks and there being this sort of gender gap and, you know, what's the male equivalent of a chick flick. And I just think that... This is one that would sort of fit into that chick flick category. There is probably a gender gap with it. It's not one. The one we'll talk about a little later, Table 19, I think would cross over and be like a good date movie. This certainly would not be a date movie. And I do think that it's mostly women who read the book. And therefore, I think it's mostly women or young, you know, girls, teenagers who would see this movie. I would certainly hope that teens would see things like Edge of 17 before they would see this one.
Fingers crossed.
Because that one was so much better.
But a real girl.
But I can see, if you go back to thinking about high school, Charlie, which was a little not...
This was not my high school.
Which was not as long ago for you.
I remember high school.
right. And so the types of movies that you went out with your friends to go see. If you were a girl, this is the type of movie you might go out and see with your girlfriend.
Titanic
in high school.
Came out my senior year.
There you go. And that one did not have the gender gap. But this one is really, it has a limited demographic appeal. And I think it is probably high schoolers, mostly girls, and young adults and people who've read the book.
Our next film, I did not see, but you did, and it looks like it's kind of getting swept under the rug. I don't see a lot of advertising for it. I don't hear anybody talking about Table 19. Is there a reason?
I'm actually defending it to some degree. It's been It seems to have been largely panned by most of the reviewers that that I've seen in the past 24 hours. I thought it was okay. Like, to me, it was just, it's okay. It is a, we haven't had any really good sort of romantic drama, romantic comedies. It's a comedy that's light to watch. It's one of those ones that you know, if you really needed to kill 90 minutes on an airplane, this is the movie you see. It's got Anna Kendrick. Who doesn't love Anna Kendrick?
Well, that was going to be my first question. How's Anna Kendrick doing?
She's good.
Oh, and I love me some Anna Kendrick.
And so, if for no other reason, you get your typical Anna Kendrick. She's endearing. She's spunky. She's funny. The script fails, to a large degree, a very solid cast. I mean, this is really all about this table at a wedding reception. And it's basically table 19 is that exiled table in the back, and it's just filled with random strangers who are trying to figure out what their connection might be to the bride and groom and who have no connection to each other. And it's that awkward feeling with, why am I sitting here with these people? And so Anna Kendrick is, she's been put at this table. She's the ex-maid of honor for the bride at this wedding, because she had been dating the bride's brother. And shortly before the wedding, the bride's brother dumped her via text after a long, like a two-year relationship. And so she wavered. She fought this internal battle at the beginning as to whether or not she would still go to this wedding. She decides to go, and she was involved in the wedding arrangements, so she knows what it means to be at table 19. It means you are at the table of people that were supposed to say thanks, but no thanks. They were supposed to just decline the reservation and send a gift. And but for one reason or another, the six people sitting at this table have their agendas, have their reasons for being there. And by the as the movie progresses, it really all takes place over the course of several hours at this wedding, involving this table of people, and they come to form a bit of an alliance and reveal bits and pieces about themselves and why they're at this wedding and what they're hoping to get out of being there. And it's got some physical comedy moments. It turns sweet near the end, and it is not going to be a wedding comedy classic at all. But it's a good rental down the line, or truly one of those ones that you'd see on an airplane and be like, all right, that was fine for a time killer.
It somewhat sounds like, and I don't want to compare it because it's a classic, it sounds like Four Weddings and a Funeral.
It's not quite, it doesn't have the depth of character as that one, because the script at Four Weddings and a Funeral had a brilliant script. This one it does not have a brilliant script, but it's got some really good actors. I mean, you've got...
Well, I wanted to notice the crossover actor. Stephen Merchant is in this movie, and he's also the albino mutant Caliban in Logan.
I'll tell you then, the guy's got range, because I wouldn't have thought that while I'm watching it. In this movie, he plays this spacey ex-convict cousin named Walter, who's living in a halfway house and shows up at this wedding, and it's uncomfortable for everyone. So he's a very good actor, and so he's kind of wasted in this. Craig Robinson and Lisa Kudrow are paired in this movie as a couple that have been married for 20 years, and they're sort of squabbling, and their marriage is on the rocks. And I think they were trying to go for the idea that they don't look like they would have much chemistry and would not seem like a really good pairing. I think the whole idea was that you had these two people that were drawn together and had a real relationship, and you're not supposed to think about like the fact that it's an interracial couple or anything like that. They are having the same problems that anyone else would have who are just growing apart after 20 years. But there is a lack of chemistry, I think, between them. And again, individually, their characters are drawn a little too flat. And then you've got June Squibb, the veteran actress from like Nebraska, and she's playing the former nanny to the bride, and she's just sort of devastated to have been placed at this table way in the back, thinking that she was being held with higher esteem by the family. And so, so you've got this very diverse group of people. You have this kid, this teenager who's basically just came to this wedding looking for a hookup. And so he's hoping to find some girl to score with. And so there's a lot of cliche action going on throughout this movie. But what saves it is that there, for all the predictability and formulaic things that are in this movie, there is a twist. And so can't give anything away, but the twist is what keeps you engaged in the movie as it progresses. It's short enough. I think it was like 89 minutes long, so it was really hit the sweet spot. If it had tried to go any longer, I think the movie would have been a real bore. But I think the fact that you had Anna Kendrick and really good actors saves the movie and makes it okay for a date night or for anyone just looking for mindless entertainment. Artie Chick, however, would be like you. She hated it.
I don't know if I would hate it. Sounds like something I'd watch on an airplane.
It's you could Anna watch Kendrick it on an airplane. You could watch it for Anna Kendrick, but my colleague Artie Chick disagreed with me vehemently on this one and just felt it's not worth anyone's time or money.
Well, the film I saw this week that you didn't see was nominated for a Best Foreign Film Oscar. It's called Land of Mine. It's from Denmark, directed by Martin Sonfleet, and it's based on a true story. May 1945, World War II just ended in Europe, and this is like the day after World War II ended. The Nazis are marching home out of Denmark, and the Danes are not sorry to see them go. They've been occupied for about 5 years. It wasn't very nice, but they take 2,000 POWs, mostly children, because by then the only people left in the German army were, kids like 15, 16 years old. They send them to the west coast of Denmark and have them dig up the 2 million mines that were emplaced in the beaches there because Hitler didn't know where the Allies were going to invade. It happened to be at Normandy, but it could have been Denmark, it could have been Norway. So they peppered the west coast of Denmark with 2 million mines. So they had 2,000 POWs, mostly children, dig these up for a couple months after the war ended. And that's technically a war crime. It's against the Geneva Conventions to do that. But you know what? The Danes were pissed. And so they had it done. And we follow a group of boys, about a dozen boys, led by this crusty Danish sergeant who, he hates these boys. He doesn't give them any food. He's starving them. They barely give them training about how to dig up these mines. So there's some explosions here. But over time, they learn to establish some sort of mutual respect. He starts to see them as human beings. It really hits home when something happens and one of them gets hurt and starts screaming for their mommy. He's like, you know what? These are boys. These are kids. Hitler would have only sent the young and useless to hold off Denmark in 1944 and 1945. But this is not about really cleaning up the beach. It's about revenge. The Danes wanted revenge, and they got it through these boys. And it's a tough watch at times because you begin to sympathize with these boys. And, they had no choice in Germany. If you were told to go to war, you go to war. You don't say no. So they're in a rock and a hard place digging up these mines. And it's a tough watch at times. And now I've seen all five Oscar-nominated foreign films. This is now my favorite one.
Wow.
It's better than the one that won, Salesman. It's better than A Man Called Uwe. It's better than Tana. It's way better than Tony Erdmann. It's a really, really good film. And I really hope people take the time to find this one.
I suspect that I would still prefer A Man Called Uwe. I think that one's still more my speed. So this is actually the only one that I think I have still not seen from among all the Oscar movies. That one sort of fell through the cracks. I didn't even realize that that I hadn't seen it. And so I guess I just feel that there's always that World War II movie in the mix of those foreign film nominees. And
well, this story's never been told. He went out and pretty much, pardon the pun, dug it up. And I love the pun in the title, Land of Mine.
Yes.
It's brilliant. The sergeant, he's played by Roland Müller. I remember him from 2013 from a hijacking. A Danish ship was captured and held hostage by pirates. It's the same year Captain Phillips came out. So mm-hmm. people were talking about the two pirate movies. One was Captain Phillips, one was a hijacking. And we don't know, like, the boys in this film, they are Nazis, and they're wearing Nazi uniforms. We don't know what they did during the war. And they probably did some bad things. So while they're pretty much getting tortured out there on the beach, you have to think, you know, am I supposed to be feeling empathy right now for Nazis? Am I feeling bad right now for boys that probably were doing something really bad 1 month ago? And that's something pretty heavy to think about. Mm-hmm. But compared to our final film, animated, nominated for the Best Animated Oscar, and it's now my favorite of the best, because I didn't like any of them.
I knew when I saw this one, I knew you would like it.
I didn't like Zootopia. I didn't see Moana. I didn't particularly care for Kubo. But My Life as a Zucchini, a Swiss film called Ma Vie de Courgette. I love this movie. It's so
Ma Vie
deep.
De Courgette. It was. It's French Swiss, and so first question I have for you, Charlie, though, is that we had two different options of seeing it. One was to see it dubbed into English, and the other option was to see it in French with English subtitles. Which did you choose?
I'll give you one damn guess which one I chose.
So I'm guessing you actually opted to see it in French with English subtitles.
Of course I did.
I watched the version that was dubbed into English. I did like this movie, too. I hate to agree with you again, but this is way better than the title would suggest. Mm. It's going to be very hard for people to get past a movie called My Life is a Zucchini. And essentially, it's this 9-year-old boy whose real name is Icare, but he prefers to be called Zucchini. And so that's kind of how he's known. But this is actually a tough movie for sort of figuring out who it's for, because it is French. It tackles some tough stuff. It doesn't shy away from sex talk, even though it's animated. And it's brilliant in color. I think the thing that stood out to me the most was the vivid colors that are in this film. But the story itself is kind of dark, the subject matter, but it's handled in a sensitive way. You have this kid who's been taken, his mother is an alcoholic who's been abusing him, and she dies in this weird freak accident, sort of. And he is taken to an orphanage. And so then the story is really about all these kids in the orphanage who all have come there with their own sort of tragic past. And they formed this bond and this family, and it's just a very touching movie in the end, but it's it's hard to figure out like what age group would be most appropriate for.
I'm gonna try to answer that. I think it's for two specific people. I think it's for adults, and I think it's for 9-year-olds. I would let my 9-year-old watch this because I think it's a great idea for kids to know. You know what? Not everyone has two parents and lives in a nice home and goes to a nice school. Some kids are orphans, and they've had miserable childhoods, and that's brought up through a character here. There's a bully called Simon, and he's got a defense mechanism. You know, he's been abandoned and neglected a lot in life, so he lashes out so you can't leave him or hurt his feelings later on. But he collects the stories of the children, so he knows where everyone came from and why they're there. He knows the girl who was sexually abused. He knows the boy who accidentally killed his mother. He knows the boy whose mom got deported, and he knows the boy whose parents OD'd on drugs. I would. My 4-year-old's not going to see this. Absolutely not. But I think this would be perfect for an American 9-year-old. And here's what I wanted to bring up to you. The difference between French and American, not audiences, parents. I think American parents, concerning this film, would have a tendency to shield. And French parents would have a tendency to expose.
Could be. I think depending on where your kids are at. Like, this is a good animated movie for smart, sensitive kids who are going to get it. But there's an element to it that I don't think would fly in an American film. The relationship that's sort of developing between the 9-year-old Zucchini and this girl Camille who shows up at the orphanage, and he's just immediately smitten with her, and she reads Kafka. And
I was wondering if anyone else saw that.
Yes, yes. And so there's a place that this goes near the end of the movie that I just think it was a little awkward. It's a little weird as to whether they are more brother-sister in relationship later on, or whether there's a hope for something else in this stage of their lives. And so that part I don't think would have made it into. I think it would have been changed, tweaked somewhat if this were an American animated film.
But when we say animated, I don't want people to think that this is drawn or on a computer. This is clay animation. This is claymation.
It's like Mr. Bill.
And the adults kind of look normal. They look like adults. But the kids, they have very large heads and very large eyes and these small vertical pink noses. And I thought, all right, why did they do that? Why did director Claude Bedas and visualizer of this film, why did he choose that? And I have one guess. When you're young, maybe 9 years old, you see adults as adults, but you see your peers and kids. Maybe you distinguish them by one distinguishing characteristic. Then each one of them has one. Mm-hmm. That one girl has the hair over her face. She tries to hide herself because she's got a scar on her eye. Ahmed looks like Ahmed. The girl's parents were deported. She's got these really large eyeglasses. So I was just my guess. Kids kind of focus on these distinguishing characteristics. I could be totally wrong. Maybe he just wanted to look oddball. But it's so... I love watching these orphans. I like their dynamic. I like how they get along together. They had this great ski trip.
Oh, right. I like that.
It's just, it's short. It's like just a little over an hour long.
Yeah. No, that was good, too, is it was about 70 minutes. And
don't watch it in English. It takes it away. This is obviously...
I don't think it takes it away.
You know why this is a European film? Because it paints the orphanage in a positive light. Like, it's a nice orphanage with nice caretakers who don't abuse the kids.
But I don't think there's any problem with seeing it dubbed into English. It absolutely grew on me. And
American stories about orphanages would never paint it in a positive light. It'd be this drafty place with cockroaches.
But I think if you want to get... Unless you're trying to teach your kid French and they want to watch it in French and learn some French, sure. But if reading subtitles is distracting, then you do have the option of finding this film dubbed into English. And it's just a smart, sweet, and sophisticated animated movie for older kids.
I love that it was nominated. Like, a movie like this I can't believe it got nominated. And I'm so happy it did.
I just hope that it finds its way. I don't think enough people really saw it or had any idea.
Well, Academy voters are supposed to see it.
I know, but do you really think when they saw a list on their, you know, oh, what have I missed? Oh, my life is a zucchini. You know, maybe they had just watched The Red Turtle. I mean, I love this one way more than The Red Turtle.
It's much better than Red Turtle. I want you to expand on that. Do you think if the 5,000-6,000 members of the Academy all saw this film, do you think Zootopia still would have won?
No, because I look at Piper winning Best Animated Short, and there were a lot of other more unique selections, but they went with the safe bet. And Zootopia was the safe bet, for sure. And but one thing I wanted to check and see is, did you catch the post-credit scene?
I did. That's brilliant. It's
the
like
audition.
The audition of the kid playing courgette.
Yes, and so it was really cool to hear the
audition
tape.
I can't believe you
saw
that.
I know. That's my proof that I watched it all the way through, even though it was a French film. But I did love that where some films will have that little bonus clip at the end that shows you an audition clip. This audition clip has been animated, and so you hear the voice of the kid who had been cast to be the voice of Zucchini, and it's just a really cute little post clip. But you have to actually know about it and stick around through the credits.
Excellent transition to back to Logan. Usually people sit through all the end credits of these blockbuster hero films because there's always a stinger at the end. Do not sit through the credits of Logan. There's nothing at the end credit of the 23-minute end credits. There's nothing there. And it's not really a Marvel movie. It's 20th Century Fox.
Well, and that made it all the more painful at the end that here I went into Logan expecting to see Hugh Jackman as I had seen him before as in these Wolverine movies, and I was tired, I was after work, and not only did I not get the movie that I was expecting, but we did sit there through the entire credit roll, and then the lights come up in the theater, and the sound of mass depression and sighs throughout the theater when people realized that there was nothing, that just added insult to injury to me.
All right, a quick recap of what we covered this evening. Logan, blech. That's the best I can put, blech.
Yeah, it's brutal. It's a brutal journey.
Before I Fall, I think you liked it better than I did, and I hated this movie. Logan's much better than this stupid movie.
No, I would not put Logan above this one. Before I Fall, if you read the book or are a young adult, then a high schooler, then you might like it.
Table 19.
Table 19 is harmless romantic comedy type of movie. It fills a void. There really just isn't anything similar out there. So if you're just looking for a date movie escape and you want a comedy, then this is a good possibility.
But since you, listener, are listening to this podcast, you're not interested in films like Logan and Before I Fall on Table 19. You're here for the true aesthetic. You're here because you're a cinemaphile. Therefore, you would go see Land of Mine and Ma Vie de Courgette in a back-to-back, in a back-to-back double feature.
I don't know about that. That seems a little much. I don't think I'm going to run out and try and catch up with Land of Mine, but I did like My Life is a Zucchini.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.